Hello, I am Joshua P. Warren, and this is Joshua P. Warren Daily. You know, one of the great things about this podcast is that, well, I can talk to you about whatever is on my mind. And, yeah, sometimes it's mystical, sometimes it's paranormal, sometimes it's spooky. But in other cases, it's just not. And, you know, I believe one of the reasons that I've always been attracted to the paranormal is because that I'm really interested in history and what happened in the past, and if it's possible to relive some of those things and witness some of those things. And it helps us sort of put ourselves in the proper context. In fact, when I was just a teenager, I mean, some of my best friends were in their 80s and 90s. They're all dead now. But I mean, I learned so much from, you know, hanging out with them and listening to them and getting a different perspective on life, which I find very valuable. So I'm telling you this because that recently I was really excited to learn that one of the greatest composers of television theme music in the 1980s, Mr. Stu Phillips, is available for interviews. He is 88 years old, and this is the guy who composed the theme to Knight Rider, to Battlestar Galactica. I mean, he worked on The Fall Guy and Buck Rogers, and I mean, the list is just kind of ridiculous. So I recently talked to him, and we played this interview, or a version of it, on Speaking of Strange. But I am not going to present to you the full uncut version of my conversation with a guy who defined the atmosphere of 1980s television, a music composer, Stu Phillips. Enjoy.
Hello, this is Joshua P. Warren, and I'm willing to bet that you have heard this theme before. Yes, that is the music to Knight Rider. I think just about everybody has heard that before. And it's amazing to know that the man who composed that iconic theme also worked on so many other themes. Battlestar Galactica, Quincy, The Fall Guy. I mean, the list goes on and on. I am an unabashed kid of the 80s, and I was amazed to find that the man who worked on all of this amazing, legendary, memorable music, Stu Phillips, he's still here. He's still with us. He's 88 years old. And I contacted him and I said, "Mr. Phillips, I'm a huge fan of your work. It has made an impression on the entire zeitgeist of an era. Can I please talk to you about your life, your experiences?" And he was happy to do so. So I am happy to present to you my phone call, my interview with Stu Phillips, the man who defined the sound, the music of 1980s television.
Well, folks, do I have a treat for you today? You know, nothing influences atmosphere more than music. And today I have the honor of interviewing a man who has literally shaped decades of atmosphere on some of the most popular TV shows ever created. Everyone knows the iconic music from shows like Knight Rider, Buck Rogers, Airwolf, Battlestar Galactica, Quincy, The Fall Guy, McCloud, The $6 Million Man, The Amazing Spider-Man. The list goes on and on. It is astounding that one man composed music for all these shows, plus lots of movies and other musical projects. He is a national treasure, and his name is Stu Phillips. His website is stuwho.com. Now, that's spelled S-T-U-W-H-O, stuwho.com. And Stu Phillips, welcome to the show, sir.
Well, hello, and welcome to all your listeners, and I hope I give you some information that you've been dying to know.
Well, you know,
if I may, one correction: I never wrote music for Airwolf.
Oh, really? Oh,
no. I never. It's just that there are some compilations that include Airwolf and Knight Rider on the same disc, and I guess it's confusing. But no, I never wrote anything for Airwolf, and also the $6 Million Man. Actually, I did write music for the pilot that got sold, but it was not called the $6 Million Man at that time. It was called Wine War, and something or other. I can't remember the whole title of it, but just to make a correction that people don't get the idea that I did the music for the series, the $6 Million Man. I did the music for the original pilot that sold the series. Women, that was it.
Well, you know, Stu, you have created so much that I think at this point people just say, yeah, Stu Phillips did it. You know, they just brush it over and onto your resume, because you have worked on so many projects that have made such a huge impact on pop culture. It's easy to see why the people would give you some credit sometimes that may be a little extra, but boy, the credit that you have is amazing. And therefore, let me just ask you right off the bat, for people who are not at all familiar with you, tell us a little bit about your background in terms of where you're from, where you are now, and your description of what you do.
Well, I'm from New York City, born and raised in New York City. Went to school at Music and Art High School, which at this time is called the LaGuardia School of Performing Arts, I believe. But it was a first thing then, and it was a high school at which you took at least a minimum of 3 music classes every day. So it was very intense, plus your academic. Then I went to Eastman School of Music for a while and decided that I needed to get into the business, that there was nothing more that I really needed to learn up at there. And a degree wasn't going to get me into the business I wanted to get into, which at that point was basically arranging. I wanted to be an arranger like Percy Faith, who was at that time, he since became a composer, but at that time Al Goodman and a whole bunch of other people, Hugo Winterhalter and everything. That was kind of like my ambition. And I hung around New York for a while, decided when I was about 20 years old, that was enough of this, I need to go to California, because that I think I'm going to do better there. And so I talked my parents into my going there for 6 weeks, and I stayed for 3 years. And actually was just doing accompanying, playing in bars. I was a pianist in bars, sitting there with a glass, and people, you know, gave me money. And ironically, one of the bars that I worked in on Sunset Boulevard, many, obviously, many, many, many years later, in 1978, right above that bar on the roof was this gigantic sign, and it said, Battlestar Galactica, Stu Phillips conducting the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra, and that was right above the bar where I used to work, and work for $5 or $1 or something in my glass. So it was kind of ironic that sign would be above that bar at that time. And let's see, then the Army drafted me. I went back to New York City, went in the Army, played on the Arlene Francis Army talent show that was on for many years. I did arrangements for the band there. And then the Army decided that was too good for me, and they sent me to Japan for 10 months. And there I formed a band, and I started doing concerts around, jazz concerts around Japan with several instrumentalists who became very, very well known in their in the Hollywood thing as studio musicians, Emil Richards and a few other. And then when I got out of the Army, I hadn't lived in New York for now 5 years, and I hadn't lived in California for 2 years, and I didn't quite know where to live, so I ended up the cheapest place, my parents. And they always take you in, you know. And from that point on, I started accompanying singers and being their music director and traveling with them. I worked with Chris Connor, who was a famous at that time jazz vocalist, and eventually worked with Jimmy Rogers, who was a famous pop folk singer who had a big hit called Honeycomb and Kisses Sweeter Than Mine. And I went on the road with him, and he was his music director. Then I ended up at a little record company called Grand Award Records in New York, and learned the trade, learned the record business, and somehow got lucky and ended up at Colpix Records as an A&R director. And then fortune smiled on me, and I had a number one record all over the world called Blue Moon by the Marcells. And all of this is for all your listeners to say, what? What's that? Who's that? Because that was all the way back in 1961 and 62. And then a thing called Johnny Angel with Shelley Favre. And from that point, I kind of edged my way sideways with record contracts that in order not to pay me large advances, they gave me opportunities to write music for some films, pay or play, and that's how I kind of edged my way into the composing business. And from that point, eventually, after 10 years in the record business, of which I was doing records and show, I was doing the Monkey Show and the Donna Reed television show, and I decided to give up the record business. I thought it was just getting a little dirty and a little out of my purview or thing that I enjoyed. And I stuck with just being a composer and arranger. And then 1974 came, and I started an association with Glenn Lawson that lasted about 14 years. And did a whole bunch of shows for him, plus shows that he didn't do, a few others like Spider-Man that you mentioned, and a thing called Chicago Story, which was kind of like the preview of every show that's on television now, with like Chicago Fire and Chicago PD and everything else. This thing was called Chicago Story, and it dealt with the police and the hospital and the fire department, all three aspects of it. So anyway, I don't know, does that bring you up to date? Or right now I live in California.
Yeah, well your career has been so vast, so diverse. Let me ask you this, what was the first instrument that you learned to play?
Piano.
Okay, and now how many instruments do you play now?
now, just a piano, because I play, when I went to Music and Art High School, I learned how to play clarinet. I became a better clarinetist than I was a pianist. But when I got to Eastman, playing clarinet was very nice, except that I needed to be a better piano player in order to demonstrate my compositions to my composition teacher. So my clarinet was became secondary. But at one point, I was a much better clarinetist than I was a pianist. And then when I started to become a pianist in bars and accompanist for singers and everything else, I became a, you know, I improved as a pianist. But let me just be honest and say I never attained the stature of the ability of John Williams or playing piano or anything like that. So
now, do you really have to know how to play every single instrument in order to compose something for that instrument? I mean, I know you need to know something about how it...
Yeah, when you learn orchestration, you have to basically know how to play every instrument. You don't have to have the ability to play it. I mean, but the thing, the knowledge of how to play it and some of the pitfalls that... are there playing the instrument, of course, necessary if you're going to orchestrate or be a composer that does orchestrate, which I would, I did, yeah. So the knowledge of how to play every instrument is necessary, really necessary. And, hey, when I was doing it right now, no, because you press buttons and a clarinet plays and you play a button and a flute plays, you know.
Yeah.
Everything is buttons and menus and drop downs and all of that stuff. There's but when I was doing it, which was the late 50s and 1960s and 70s, and most of the 80s, the late 80s is when stuff started a little bit with the computers. The synthesizers, of course, were around since. You know, since Spellbound and Lost Weekend, you know. But nowadays, I can't answer the question as to whether how many of the composers are knowledgeable. With the ability to play, you know, all the instruments or not. Some of them are, obviously. The Newmans and John Williams and the late Jerry Goldsmith, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, there's a few guys who came up with the rock groups who are now, you know, big famous composers. And I can't answer whether or not they learned how to do it or just give it to their orchestrator and let him do it, you know, let him figure it out.
So now when you were working on all these TV shows, what came first, the music or the filming? You know, what was
well,
the order?
In almost 90% of the cases, the film, you always get the film and, to write the music to. But in some instances, you need to pre-record music because they have to shoot certain scenes, and it's necessary that they know what the music's going to be. Like, for instance, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, I had to write all the songs and make demos of the songs so the singers could lip sync to the playbacks when they did the movie, you know. So there are some instances of that. I know there are some directors who like the composer to write several, you know, temp music for a certain scene that they like to play during the filming of the scene for mood, you know, which of course goes all the way back to the 1920s when film first started out, and they used to have like little string quartets or a little violin and piano or something playing music because it was all silent film. So, but they played music to get the actors into the mood. So that goes back almost 100 years. And they've started doing that again. I remember reading a few articles of some composers that had been asked to write a couple of scenes so that the director could play it for mood for the scene. So, but in most instances, you always get the picture. Unfortunately, you never get a completely final cut. You always get a picture that the director or producer just can't keep his hands off of and keeps recutting and recutting and recutting, you know.
Well, you know, the music, it really has to be able to capture the essence and the spirit of the show. So what is your creative process like? How do you watch this footage and see what this product is supposed to be and then create music that really captures that sense, that soul, that essence?
Well, sometimes it's very obvious. You have two people doing a love scene. You're not going to write action music, you know. But I have to speak on two levels here. It's when I worked and nowadays, okay? When I worked, you would have a discussion with the producer. I worked basically with producers for some reason. I rarely worked with directors. I generally always seemed to come out working with the producer. And we would look at the picture, decide where music was going to be. If I was concerned that some scene could be treated several different ways, I might ask the producer, "Do you want me to be lighthearted about this? Do you want me to be serious about it? You know, how would you like the music to go?" And sometimes some producers would say, "I'll leave it up to you." And other producers would say, "Well, I definitely don't want this to get heavy-handed. You know, I don't want it over the top, so just keep..." You'd get suggestions from these people. You would do it, and most of the time, if you were doing a decent job, they left you alone. You know, didn't make a lot of changes. Unfortunately, nowadays, they not only make changes, they throw out scores completely, they redo them. They have two composers, they have track music, they do everything nowadays. So, as I said, I'm speaking on two levels. Nowadays, I think it's a lot different. Obviously, it's the directors who are basically, if we're talking about film, directors are always in charge. If you're talking about TV, it's more likely you're talking about producers. Because directors are long gone after they shoot an episode of television. They're on to some other project. They haven't got time to be involved. So you're generally involved with a producer or associate producer. But in film, it's always the director, and they have gotten to the point that they consider themselves semi-composers nowadays. And they know everything, and they're very, very anti-theme, thematic. Why, I have no idea. I think they think it's corny, but they don't realize that 80% of their audience is corny and has no objection to hearing a beautiful theme played over a love scene. You know what I mean?
Right.
They don't object to it. And for some particular reason, the directors seem to put their efforts into pleasing some West Coast and East Coast critics. And I have no idea, because it started in the late 80s where they're, like, "Oh, don't get the word they use is schmaltzy on me. In other words, don't give me all this pretty music when they're doing this. Just give me, like, something to fill up the space, fill up the air." I always used to say, "Well, why don't you use room tone? Why waste your money on music? You know, just bring up the room tone, bring out some outside sirens or something, police cars or something going that outside the window." You know, I said, why do you want to waste $1,000 to write a piece of music that you're not even going to hear and doesn't mean anything? You know, of course, that sometimes didn't go over too well with producers, but. As I said, it's two different levels. The level I'm talking about, and you asked me about how I approach it, it's It basically scenes tell you exactly what they want. Push me, you know, advance me, make me sound more, feel more exciting, you know. Lord knows how many car chases I've done in my lifetime. But, you know, the feeling is advance the action of the car chase, you know, and make it the car sound faster, make chase sound more exciting than it is with the music. Sometimes if you're lucky, you can hear the music. Other times, forget about it. You know, you can't even hear it, so I don't even know why it's written. And the most famous thing that's ever happened is when some producer once asked me to use the chase music from Bullet, the Steve McQueen movie.
Uh-huh.
And if you're aware of that movie, there is music on the stalking of the car as he follows it all the way up until the time that he shifts and puts his foot on the accelerator and starts to chase. At that point, the music ends. There is no music. And yet you will have producers or directors who are so unaware of it that they'll say, I want the music from Bullet, the car chase music from Bullet. And there is no car chase music in Bullet.
Wow.
You know, it's very strange. You're dealing with producers and directors sometimes. They really sometimes are in a world of their own, and they don't realize what they're talking about. It would be a lot nicer if they allowed composers the same latitude they allow the writers, you know, the creativity. However, to probably be critical of what I just said, they are also, if you look on the thing, 3 writers, 4 writers, 5 writers, because they are changing even the writers, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very hard to find something written by one guy, one person, one male, one female or something, or one person. So, I don't know, it's all kind of filtered down now, and I'm very happy that I'm not... that I'm not writing music for this because I don't think I would enjoy it the way it's being done nowadays. Of course, there are exceptions. I watched a few TV things last night in my theater, and I thought the music was just, you know, wonderful. You know, it was a lovely, lovely job, well done. And so you get these things where it sounds like there was a complete agreement between director or producer and composer, and then they allowed the latitude of some creativity to be able to do what you do, you know. It's like the cinematographer or any of those things. They all are creative people, and at one point you have to allow them some creativity. But,
Well, now, you know, speaking of car chases, I would say that, you know, one of the things you composed that everybody knows is the theme to Knight Rider.
Uh-huh.
Please tell us the story of how that came about.
It's not a big story. I mean, they actually shot this 2-hour movie thing, and they actually tracked, libraried some music into it, and the film editor, I believe, tracked in some obscure piece of synth music. Now, this was 1982, so there wasn't a hell of a lot of it around, you know, but he found some obscure piece of synth music, which was nothing. It had no rhythmic pulse or anything else. It was just some synth music to show that because the car is got a voice that talks and everything else, that synthesized music might work. So the network bought the idea that the synthesized music would work. But Glenn Lawson really didn't want a score that was synthesized. He said he still wants to hear an orchestra play. But he and I talked about the main theme, and he said, yeah, the network is so excited about this idea of a synthesizer and everything else. So he said, let's come, you know, come up with a synthesizer type of music. So I worked on it and played a few things for him, and we talked about it, and he made suggestions, and I made suggestions, and eventually he said, all right, let's get this thing done. So I got a session, and at that particular time, I figured to myself, well, since I'm not that well-versed in synthesizers, I hired 4 synthesizer players and the rhythm and percussion and everything else, and I wrote out parts for all 4 synthesizers, which, of course, nowadays one guy plays and he overdubs 80 times or something, you know. But at that time, I felt like, hey, this was, you know, why not just treat it like an orchestra and there's 4 guys playing synthesizers? And that's what we did. And it was a little unusual for the time, but I can honestly be very proud to say that I beat Miami Vice by 6 months. Yeah, that Miami Vice didn't come out till 6 months after Knight Rider. So I'm sure Jan Hammer did not need to hear any of my music to compose his music. He was definitely a good composer, and but the funny thing is, people who say, "Oh yeah, well, wait a minute, what did you took that from Miami Vice?" I said, "No, Miami Vice came out 6 months after I did." So anyway, that's it. It was not a big, you know, deal. The melody, the dub da 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 da, is very similar to a classical piece, and something that's rarely ever played, and God only knows why that was in my head. But while I was playing that running theme, the bum ba da 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 da, with one hand, and as I said, not being the greatest of pianists, and Glenn said, we need to have a tune that goes on top of it. And I said, oh, great. So I tried to play the simplest thing I could figure out, that I could play the left hand and the right hand at the same time. And it just fell on that thing there, and I've been questioned for years and years, oh, well, did you purposely use that thing? I had no idea. I hadn't heard that piece of music probably in 70 years or something. So, but basically that's kind of how it happened. And then network was excited. They loved it. And after I did my episodes of Knight Rider and went to 20th Century Fox to do Fall Guy, and Don Peake, after a couple of other composers in front of him, Don Peake took over doing it somewhere around season 3 or something. They decided that they would change the theme. And the librarian at Universal called me up. He was my friend, and he said they're talking about changing the Knight Rider theme. So I told Glenn, and Glenn said, over my dead body. And so he called the network, and the network called Universal and said, if you change that theme, we'll drop the show. So that took care of that. So I think they re-recorded it. I think Don Peake did a re-recording or something of the theme. I don't know why, but I don't bother to listen to any of that music.
You know what, Stu? I just want to bring up as a side note here, obviously you are considered by many people to be one of the pioneers of bringing the synthesizer into the modern age. And I am one of those rare birds who actually plays a theremin. And I wonder, have you ever done much with theremins?
I did one thing. I did one thing with the theremin, and God, I can't remember. I can't remember what it was. But no, but I was, as I said, the synthesized sounds go back quite a ways to the theremin and a few other instruments. I used the Yamaha E3 organ, or something, mm-hmm. which is basically kind of a computer-sounding thing, you know? It wasn't really an organ. It was a little cross between it. I used that quite often. And then, of course, the several of the other keyboard instruments came out. And I used some of those. I'm just trying to think. The first thing, 1969, I did a movie called The Name of the Game is Kill, where I used a lot of synthesized sounds and music in it with an orchestra. And not only that, I electrified all the cellos. I electrified just about every percussion. Everything had an amp. Every 8 cello players, and they all had amplifiers like a guitar thing, and they all plugged in. I used a lot of synthesizers in that movie. And that was long before, that was 69, so that was long before 82 and Knight Rider. I also used a synthesizer in Battlestar Galactica in 78. With the Los Angeles Philharmonic, I hired Mike Boddicker, and he played with the Philharmonic on the stage there. And I used the synthesizer like just another section of the orchestra. So there was, I didn't feature it basically that much, but he was playing and he was mixed in with the Philharmonic, you know, as just another sound palette of sound with the orchestra. Then, of course, Fall Guy, I did a lot of synthesizers in that. In fact, I did about 10 episodes or 8 or 10 episodes with just some of them with nothing but synthesizers and rhythm section, and some of them with synthesizers and an orchestra. But I never went for the layering or the overdubbing, one guy overdubbing himself. I always, like, if I'd hire 2 synth players, you know, I always treated the synthesizers as a section of the orchestra. And I mean, that's not to say that at some times I didn't decide at the end of the session to sweeten something and you know, and double some synthesizer stuff. But basically, I always treated the synthesizers as part of the orchestra, just another section, you know. Go ahead.
You know, Stu, I tell you, some of these themes that you have created, like Knight Rider or Buck Rogers,
Hold it. I did not write the song to Buck Rogers.
Oh, you didn't?
No, okay. I didn't. Well, you look carefully on the credits. I did not write the song. Glenn Lawson and a friend of his wrote the song to Buck Rogers. I did not write the song. I did write in the original Buck Rogers pilot. The song melody didn't quite fit everything that was going there, so I did write a secondary theme that was the theme of the Buck Rogers original movie pilot movie thing. But and I used that basically in the episodes that I did do of Buck Rogers. But no, I did not write the song.
Well, but so many of the things that you have written, they get stuck in my head for days, even weeks sometimes. Does that happen to you as well when you are creating these things? You can't get it out of your head? It drives you nuts?
Well, yeah. Even today, the last thing I hear on the radio or the last thing I work on or something is stuck in my head for 10, 15, 20 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even if I'm brushing my teeth and listening to a classical radio, when I shut it off, the last thing that was playing is what I got in my head, you know, whether it's Bach or Beethoven or Rachmaninoff or Bernstein, you know.
Yeah.
Things stick in my head for a while after I listen to them. And sometimes I wake up, sometimes when I was working and I was getting up and everything else, I would get this great idea, and I would sit down and I would write it, And I say, boy, that sounds familiar. And then I would try, I say, oh, boy, I'm worried now. I don't want to, subconsciously steal somebody's steam without knowing it. And then when I finally traced it out, I discovered I wrote it. Yeah, I discovered, like, oh, I know what that is. That's from Jim. Yeah, I wrote that. That's what I wrote. So, yeah, some of these things would stick in my head, and I'd, which if you listen to a lot of the composers, what's called their style or their sound or something else ends up being pretty much what they've written before they write again. Because if the guys liked it the first time, you'll love it the second time. And I'll go back as far as people like Mikolas Rozsa and Tiomkin and some of the great names from the golden age of film scoring. And if you listen to some of their scores, I mean, you take Mikolas Rozsa's Spellbound and Lost Weekend, which he did in the same year. You could take one score from one picture and put it in the other picture and take that score and put it in that picture, and it both work. It would work on either picture because he was basically writing the same thing, you know?
So now,
take anything away from Mikolas Rozsa, who could write completely different, but he was writing what he was paid for. You know, people would say, hire Mikolas Rozsa, and say to him, okay, I want Rozsa, you know, give me Mikolas Rozsa. So he gave him what he did before. That's the way of the world. That's what you,
Yeah.
Yeah, well, write 20 episodes of a detective thing, keep writing the same thing because that's what people want to read. That's what they like.
Why, sure. Yeah. And in your case, you know, having worked on so many different projects, aside from Knight Rider, what are some of the pieces of music that you feel ended up as the final product, a very pure representation of what you created? Because, I mean, basically what you created for Knight Rider, more or less, that's what we know as the Knight Rider theme. What are some other themes that you feel like stand up to what your original vision was?
Well, not so much themes as some films that I've done that are kind of obscure. I did a surfing film called Follow Me, of which I think is some of the best music I wrote, I've written, in my opinion, and I'm prejudiced, of course. But in my opinion, I think I fulfilled my job to the best, and I wrote stuff that I really, really, really like. It was just unfortunate that the film did not catch on big like some of the other surfing films did. That's one. It's out on disc. Most of it, not the complete score, but at least three quarters of the score is out on disc. But Follow Me, and then I revisited the first movie I ever wrote for a major studio, which was a Danny Kaye movie called The Man from the Diners Club. And I had not listened or played or anything else because God only knows where the tapes are. Record companies have asked me about them. I can't. Nobody, Columbia or Sony, knows where anything is anymore. But I revisited them. It came out on DVD. They put it out, and I revisited it, and I said, my God, I said, that was my first major movie, and to tell you the truth, I don't think 25 years later I was writing any better than I did for that first movie. And I kind of like fell in love with my score and said, gee, for a person who really didn't know what they were doing, you sure did a good job, you know. It was just that kind of a thing, because at that point I had done one minor B-movie in 1959 called Mad Dog Cole. But that was mainly a jazz score. But this was the first big movie with a big star, with a big orchestra, and I basically didn't know what the hell I was doing and ended up, in my opinion, writing one of my better scores that I've ever written. So those kind of things, they hang with me.
But do you feel like Knight Rider is your? Do you feel like Knight Rider is what most people know you for, though?
Well, both of them, Knight Rider and Battlestar.
Mm-hmm. Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, the original, the 1978 version, not the 2002 version. When I was traveling, promoting my book, went to Europe, did a few Knight Rider conventions and everything else, people knew me for both of them. I would say probably at the time I was doing the stuff in Europe, Knight Rider a little more. But now, lately, Battlestar Galactica, the request, this whole concert season during the summer for copies of the orchestra thing to perform at concerts has really, really taken off, you know, been a lot more than it had been. It had been kind of quiet, you know, and all of a sudden this has gotten like to be one of the standard sci-fi themes, you know, to play at all these sci-fi concerts, along with the Williams and Goldsmith and Horner and all the others. So I felt very good about that. And Knight Rider, of course, nobody asked to play because it's a, you know, synthesizer thing. Yet I wrote an orchestral version of it, which I was hoping, people might do just as an encore piece. It only runs a minute and 25 seconds, but nobody seems interested in it. It's a standalone by itself. That's it. It's Knight Rider. It's what it sounds like. God knows how many versions there are on YouTube. They're endless of all the people who have redone it and sweetened it and used it in rap records. Jay-Z and I don't even want to go through the whole list of rap artists that have used the Knight Rider theme or parts of it, or in one case, one record by an Indian, can't think of his name right now, all he used was the bass line. That's all he used, but then he combined with Jay-Z, and Jay-Z sweetened it, and Jay-Z put it in his one of his albums, so needless to say, I did very well monetarily on that.
So you do get a royalty, though. So
Yeah, of course I do, yeah. I don't get a royalty from all the YouTube uses of it, unfortunately. The publisher might be getting some, and it might be in my publishing statement, you know, my portion of the money. But I mean, not direct BMI money am I getting on that, but my BMI royalty on all the other usages, yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's good, because I'd wondered if you just did that stuff strictly for hire. And
yeah, I did it strictly for hire, but that still doesn't mean I didn't give up my performing rights.
Good.
Yeah,
well,
this is not unusual for me. I mean, all the composers working at the studios, they're all employees for hire, but their contracts all say that they retain their performing rights, BMI or ASCAP, and they also retain their rights to mechanical royalties should sheet music or CDs or whatever be made. Now, of course, it's a little more complicated because you have to put in all this internet, the Pandora and all the internet radio stations that play things, and so it's a lot more complicated now. Basically, with the exception of one or two composers in my day, studios always owned music. They always own. They're the publisher. They have the publishing, and they own the tracks, and they own the music. but you get your royalties, you get your performing royalties and your mechanical royalties. I think Henry Mancini used to make had deals where he shared with the studios. I can't think offhand of some others. Some others may have done it. Nobody ever knew about it. You know, contracts are confidential.
Right.
Yeah, but basically that was the thing, and that's basically still it. I can't. You know, I'm sure there's some artists or some groups that make a deal with the directors. Like, hey, I'm not going to do this score for you. You want me real bad. I'm not giving up my rights to this thing. I want part of the publishing. I want, you know, whatever. I don't know. As I said, contracts are confidential. Nobody knows what everybody's deals are. But, you know, word gets around.
Sure.
Deals are being made.
So now, when you are working on one of these pieces, is there a moment where you say, ah, it's done, it's finished, and you know that it is exactly where it needs to be, or do you have a tendency to always want to keep revising it? Did they have to sort of, you know, pull it out of your hands? How does that work for you?
Well, me personally, I'm generally, when I'm done with something and I think it's right, it's right. I don't revisit it. I can't speak for everybody else, but I know there's some composers, like you say, you can't rip it from my dead hands until I want to I want to fix this, I want to fix that bar, I want to fix that, which is just exactly like the directors say, hey, I don't want to turn it over yet. I got a shot I want to put in, you know, I want to take that shot out. In my particular case, I would say majority of the time when I was done with it, I was done with it. I was finished with it. Now that I just compose and for my pleasure and to keep my mind alive, I do constantly revisit and change things over and over again, you know. And sometimes I've looked at things like 2 years later after I've written it and say, why did I write that, you know, and I fix it and change it. But I have found stuff that I've written that I listen to and say, boy, I wouldn't change a note of that. You know, it's done. It's finished. It's over. So who knows? Maybe if I didn't have deadlines and wasn't writing something on Wednesday that was getting recorded on Thursday, maybe I would have been, you know, a little more critical of myself on writing, and maybe I would have made changes. But who knows? When I had to be on the stage at 9 o'clock in the morning and it was 10 o'clock the previous night, and I finished a cue, I said, that's finished, it's done, it's over.
Yeah. And you've hinted at this, and it's up to you whether or not you want to come right out and say your age, but you are a man who's been around for a long time. Your mind is obviously...
I don't care. Anybody can know my age.
How old are you right now?
I'm 88 years old.
Okay, so now you obviously have a very sharp mind, and how much of that do you think is because that you have spent so many decades involved with music?
I think most of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think most of it. I think that's why I do. That's why I do music every day, unless I have, you know, plans to do something other than that. If I really have an empty day, I spend it 3-4 hours doing music, because I believe that it's like a puzzle, and it keeps your mind alive. It keeps you. It keeps all the fibers going, and it keeps the blood flowing. And no, absolutely, the answer to your question is yes. You know, I'm not a big reader, so some people keep their mind alive just reading a lot, and some people love to do crossword puzzles and everything. I sit down, music is a puzzle to me, you know. How to get from here to there, and how to do, you know, and you're always learning music, truthfully. Nobody knows everything about it. It's a learning process all your life, actually, and you're always finding new things that probably somebody else found a long time before you did, you know, but you just discovered it. It's like finding the lost chord, you know. Oh, I found it. Well, somebody else found it 10 years ago.
So what's next for you? What is the big project that that you want to really...
I don't have any big projects, and I'm not looking for them because every time I talk to any of my friends or something, they tell me these stories, and I say to myself, you know what, I just wouldn't have the patience anymore to deal with, you know, with this. So it would have to be an exceptional thing. I mean, I had a friend, an actress who wants to become a director, so she put together a 15-minute little thing, and she asked me a favor. She says, can you, you know, do some music for me? But she had tracked in some music, and it was fine. I said, what's the matter with what you tracked in? She said, well, you know, I can't clear it without paying a lot of money. So, I helped her out on that. I wrote a little thing for her for the middle thing, and I even wrote a song. I even wrote a song for her to replace the. She had an Irving Berlin song there, which, of course, is one of the hardest things in the world to clear. Little things like that, plus the fact that I'm, my own librarian for sending out Battlestar Galactica things to different orchestras all over, and I'm building up a library of. I don't know if your fans are aware, since you're talking about film music and everything else, but I had a thing called the Hollywood Strings on Capitol Records, which became very popular because the first album I did was called The Beatles Songbook, and it was everything I wanted to do as an arranger. I was writing these lush arrangements of Beatles songs, but I retained the Beatle rhythm section sound so that they weren't like elevator music. And they became very popular, everybody, the fans of the Hollywood Strings, constantly send me things. When are we going to get new ones? And for 20 years, I've been trying to get Capitol to authorize doing some more, and they don't want to spend the money because there's not enough. There's not enough profit to be made because it's not a big seller in there. You know, if you don't sell 100,000 or 200,000 CDs, forget about it. You know, they're not interested in selling 6,000 or 7,000. And so I can't get anybody interested in doing it. But meanwhile, just in case, I keep writing arrangements of Hollywood Strings, and I've got, you know, about 18 or something that I've been doing over the years. Figure, oh, maybe someday somebody will say, oh, let's do Hollywood Strings, you know. Who knows?
And you wrote an autobiography called Stu Who, 40 Years of Navigating the Minefield of the Music Business.
Yeah, well, gee, it's a lot more than 40 years now. More like 55 years. I did. I don't like to think of it as an autobiography. It's just it's high points in my career, and how I got through the twists and turns and the labyrinths of the music business, having to do with records and film and TV since I started, and even playing piano in bars and accompanying singers and everything. So, I mean, I've had a very, varied career from through every form of music that really exists right now, except for heavy classical, of which I am a classical trained musician and listen to classical music on the radio all the time. I don't listen to Pop 40 anymore, or definitely not hip-hop or rap or anything. So I've been through the whole gamut of music all the way through, you know, making hit records, making flop records, writing television, the Monkees, 2 years of the Monkees, which is enough to drive anybody crazy. record company just released the CD of the Monkees songbook, which I did on Epic Records in the late 60s, and they just released that, so that thing is on CD now. And then, looking into some record companies are looking into finding, trying to get licenses or finding tapes on some things that I've done that they'd like to put out. And basically, what we're working on now is trying to do Fall Guy, because there's 96 episodes I did of that, and there's a lot of varied music in that. But for some reason, they're having trouble getting Fox to pay any attention to it. I don't know. They can't figure out why, because these studios have absolutely nothing to lose. You know, they don't pay a cent and they get money. So.
Yeah.
It's a good deal for them all around, but somehow they get a little sticky about it. It's been almost 20 years that I've been trying to get Fall Guy. And I got a company right now that says that they've gone over the head of somebody there to somebody else in another department who says, "Oh yeah, why not? Let's get into that." So, you know, when an executive at some place says, "Let's get into that," that could mean months, years, and he may not even be there anymore.
Well, the clock has got us, unfortunately, but I want to let all of our listeners know that, again, you can go to stuwho.com, stuwho.com, stuwho.com. And, Stu, you know, I want to tell you, sir, I am in my 40s, so I'm going to be bold enough to speak on behalf of my generation and probably some others, and thank you so much for the wonderful entertainment and the musical magic that you have given us for so many decades. It is just a real thrill and honor to be able to speak with you, and I cannot wait to see what Stu Phillips is going to produce next. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Hi,
sir.
Joshua, it was my pleasure, and tell your fans out there, I do answer my emails.
All right, that sounds good. You heard it, folks. StuWho.com.
Okay, Joshua, nice speaking with you, and a pleasure, and thank you for putting me on.